Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your don't know how to behave of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. I don't know about you, but I am feeling somewhere near my age. That was 22, Taylor Swift, live. I couldn't tell you what date, because we're just going to use the one where we got the best audio. But 22, a regular on the set list of the Eras Tour. Last week, we did Taylor Swift Eras Tour Speed Round Part 1. We're back. It's Taylor Swift Eras Tour Speed Round Part 2. Three segments this week. Karen Gans is here. You know Karen's coming through to talk about Eras Tour. That's number one. Verinda Jagoda is coming through. Josh Duboff is here. We are going to talk about various facets. We're going to talk about fan outfits. We're going to talk about Taylor's relationship to celebrity culture. We're going to talk about Karen's parking at MetLife Stadium. There's a lot of tangents, corollaries, tributaries that we're going to be getting into this week. The Eras Tour was recently announced, number one, that there is going to be a cinematic experience. There will be a theatrical rendition of the Eras Tour. So if you could not get to one of the cities or don't want to wait till next year to see it or see it again, it's going to be in theaters sometime in October, I believe. So there's that. There's the international dates coming up. There's not going to be any shortage of Eras Tour coverage. But I think for now, this episode will conclude our Taylor Swift Eras Tour coverage. Without further ado, it is Karen Gans. Karen.
What's up, John?
Tell me your Eras Tour trauma. No, I'm just playing.
No. Are you serious? Because you know.
No, I wasn't. But what I know is that Karen went to Eras Tour here, which when I say here, I mean New Jersey.
Yeah.
I was joking about trauma, but do you want to lead with the bad?
No, I do have trauma. I could not find my car in the parking lot after the Eras Tour.
This is the part of Eras Tour nobody talks about. This is real, like, you know what this is? This is real common man lament about the Eras Tour. This is like if Oliver Anthony was singing about Eras Tour, this is the part that he'd be singing about. Like, lost my car in the parking lot, wanted to make it home, didn't have a shot. You know, like, kind of like, yeah.
Ooh, look at you.
Yeah. Really, 8 mile up here. So no one talks about the logistical challenges. But what I will say is, I think that is a salient point, because everybody talks about the conviviality, the gathering, how joyful it is to have 70,000 people all in the same space sharing the same passion. But no one's talking about how challenging it is for each of those 70,000 people, like the individual struggles that people are overcoming to share this collective experience. And that's not nothing. So for everyone who's listening, just know we also struggle. We have the same struggles.
It was striking that everybody had gone in early to see the openers because Taylor had put, you know, her imprinter on these openers and instructed people to watch them. I've never been at a show where everybody was there like 3 hours before me to see all the openers.
Yeah, sure. Right. No, because we have years of practice of showing up at like the precise moment to miss all the kind of like the extraneous stuff and just get to the heart of it.
And I would have been happy to see Phoebe Bridgers, but unfortunately the traffic at the Holland Tunnel or the Lincoln Tunnel, whichever I was in, did not accommodate.
We will catch Phoebe on the next go.
Yes, I have seen Phoebe before. But anyway, at the end, I had, you know, obviously I look at the set list. I knew what was happening. I thought that I was very clever when I darted from my seat during the final notes of Karma. I believe it's Karma. And I was like, I'm going to be the first person at this parking lot. Could not find the car. Really almost collapsed, like almost had to sit down. And then wait till I tell you how I found the car. Popcast listeners, this is some real CSI.
Let's go.
I had taken a photo of cars near me. But you know how you're supposed to take a photo of where you park to remember? I forgot to do that. But I had taken a photo of a car decorated to say getaway car, like the song Getaway Car, one of my favorite slick Taylor songs.
Dressing up for the show and dressing up the car for the show.
Yes.
And
the moment of like, I had reached the moment of like past regular panic. Like I was absolutely freaking out. My phone was running out of juice. I couldn't reach anybody. I was alone in the parking lot. I remembered the photo on my phone of the car dressed up like getaway car. And I zoomed in and there was a letter and a number for where that car was.
Oh
near.
My God.
And that is how I found my car. I've watched enough crime dramas in my day to know that I should be scouring for evidence.
Yes.
And I found it and I was like absolutely
incredible.
Elated. And that is how I found my car. Anyway, this is a very long story.
That's why you still work at the New York Times. Like
I almost cried.
You could have just been, that's what I'm saying. You could have just been forever in that parking lot.
This has happened once or twice before. The worst was at Coachella. I couldn't find my car at Coachella. Yeah. Hot, tired, you know, no phone. I sat down and just like literally started to cry and somebody came and helped me. You know, I was like on deadline.
Yeah, sure.
Couldn't find my car.
Oh, I know. I can relate.
Terrible situation. But anyway, I will also say just in reaction to what you said earlier about the conviviality at the tour, certainly there was a lot of that. I also was surrounded by a lot of white teen obnoxiousness at the Taylor show. And I'm from Long Island and it was not a type of white teen obnoxiousness that was unfamiliar to me. It was unfortunately in a PTSD manner familiar to me. I will say when I returned for the Beyonce show, it was a much warmer, more of a cultural hug, I would say. And it extended to the staff that when I entered the Beyonce show, and I was wearing a Madonna Into the Groove shirt because I dressed for literally one song, which was the Queen's remix of Break My Soul. As I was entering, first of all, the people at the gates, the security people and the ushers were like dancing at Beyonce. They were high-fiving us on the way in. And the woman was like, get ready to get your groove on. And I was like, I will. It was a very different vibe in the exact same stadium. I would say even more convivial.
What do you think about the current version of Taylor fandom led to that at this moment?
I will say that this Taylor fandom obviously wasn't broke. You know, to get tickets to the show was a challenge, and particularly in the seats that I was privileged to have, you know, as I had a press ticket.
Yeah.
It was a privileged seat, and the people sitting around me were shall we say in one word, privileged.
An important thing that we don't talk about enough.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, you know, we've covered it a little bit, but like how challenging it was to get tickets to the show, how expensive they were, how fast they went, and then how amplified the prices were on the resale market. So with that comes, I would say, two types of fans. One, extremely dedicated, like high fever pitch fans, or alternately, people who can pay.
Yeah, I think I was sitting by people who could pay. And I think, honestly, I would have liked to have returned in a bleachers situation and maybe shared a different experience.
Oh, she'll be back. We'll go in the nose. We'll sit in the nosebleeds.
Okay. I mean, honestly, I appreciated my seat and I have wonderful video from the show and I enjoyed it. Obviously, we will talk about the music at some point.
Yes.
I'm happy to talk about the details surrounding it. What if my segment has nothing to do with her performance?
It's totally fine. Totally
only
fine.
About parking and fans.
It'll make for a great blurb when I write the blurb.
But what does she really think? See, I'm avoiding telling you. It's very clever.
So people who can pay, right? And I think, broadly speaking, when we go to shows, you know, go to the Bowery Ballroom, Irving Plaza, Terminal 5, whatever. It's like you're pretty sure the people who are there like really, really, really want to be there. Like it's dedicated. It's a small to medium sized room. They're making time to take carving out of their evening to go to this place. But it is interesting when you get over a certain stardom level or a certain success level, there's something where people go for the cachet of going. Like, for example, you look on Instagram the last 5 days from today, everyone's at the U.S. Open. Of those people, how many of those people really care about tennis? I don't know. Is it 20%, 50%, 80%? Is it just people who want the flex? I don't know. But I'm saying there are certain things for which the flex is more important than the fandom or the interest.
I think that is more common, though, for shows in the city. You have to get into a car and drive to MetLife Stadium, or you have to, like, you know, rent a limo or something. It's a little bit more of a challenge. It's a more elaborate flex. I mean, you have to put yourself out to get to that venue. I have found at MSG, if I'm sitting in good seats at something, there are oftentimes business folk, you know, who are entertaining clients in the seats around me who could not care less about the artist, you know, and they're just like drinking and talking, and it makes me insane. I know it makes artists insane too. I'm trying to remember who. It might even be Springsteen. Somebody yelled at people recently in their crowd about that. It was like, you don't even want to be here. But I can't remember who. It's going to kill me. I will Google post-podcast. Anyway, but it was a flex though.
Do you think Taylor and Team Taylor and Taylor Tour, is it materially different if the people who are in the good seats are there for the flex or if they are the most devoted fans? Because maybe if the front three sections are like a little sus, but you've got 75,000 other people there. So it's like, doesn't really matter.
I think even the people there for the flex, though, are intimately familiar with the music because it's such a lingua franca. You know, like maybe they know the bigger songs. I mean, she plays like 100 songs. I'm exaggerating only slightly. So yeah, sure. They probably know a lot of them. And they're just so deeply embedded in the fabric of our culture right now that I think it's not like we're at like a Rush show, you know, or something where people might know Tom Sawyer, but like they don't know anything else. It's not like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, sure.
I just really wanted to bring Rush into the Taylor Swift conversation.
Yes, I'm going to let you get away with that.
Yeah, that's not necessary. I just couldn't think of another example.
Okay. You've been to a bunch of Taylor tours, I know.
I have. I've been to Reputation and to 1989, and I think that's it.
Do you feel like what this tour was trying to achieve was fundamentally different from what those tours relative to those time periods were trying to achieve?
Yes, because those were very attuned to their respective albums, and they had the flavor and the vibe and the taste and everything. The aesthetics were just very anchored. You know, Reputation tour, there were snakes everywhere.
There sure were.
A lot of dark imagery. And this
I really
one,
regret not buying, like the Reputation merch was so terrible, but I really regret not buying it because I just felt like, I don't even know if it aged well. It's just so emblematic of a bizarre period that I just feel like I should own some of it. I'll go on eBay after this and maybe just like dig up something. But anyway,
I was going to say, I'm sure you could get your hands
on
something.
I'm confident I can. Yeah.
Yeah, something on Etsy is remaking that merch for you as we speak. But there was something, I don't want to be negative because I really did enjoy the tour, but there was something just so exhausting about the Eras conceit that you knew that it was sort of like a slog through each album. And like, you know, I like these albums all very much. Yes, even Folklore and Evermore. I don't love them, but I like them. And I don't want to retract too much of my prior criticism.
Blocked and unfollowed.
I have found ways to appreciate them in their ways, but
I can't wait till like 5 years from now where I'm like, I do the finally, like, it's all been a bit. It's just a bit. I love these records.
Well, no, we've gone through so much over those albums. I can't leave you. I still stand with you.
Thank you.
But they weren't even my particular favorites from those albums. I mean, not like it's her job to discern my favorites.
No, but I agree. I felt the same. I felt totally the same.
Yeah. And there was sort of like, not that it would have worked better all jumbled up. You know, I don't even know what way would work best, but there was something to me just kind of like discombobulated. It wasn't chronological. That bothered me in a way. Like I wanted to follow the growth or the narrative or, you know, just follow the thread of her career in some way. So I felt like I was jumping around a little bit. The other thing I'll say, which will sound critical, likely because it is that, you know, I'm just trying to protect my neck over here, John. As a wise man once said.
Join me on the dark side.
No, it's just that to me, Taylor is a brilliant singer-songwriter and a brilliant musician. She is also a brilliant performer. I don't think she's a brilliant pop performer. And this is a pop spectacle show with all the trappings of pop spectacle. And Taylor, to me, it's more like she's performing being a pop performer than being a pop performer. And she's so exceptionally well-practiced and good at it. I mean, you really, it's... She sounded great, obviously, singing live. I really didn't hear too many clunkers. I thought she sounded really good. You know, the parts of that are rehearsed that she does every show where she makes, like, you know, she flexes before the man and she talks about being strong. I know every artist on a stage that size, you know, a lot of it is practiced. It's like a Broadway show in many respects. You know, there's cues, there's lighting, there's pyro, there's whatever. You have to hit your marks. There is something about it with her that feels just a little practiced. A little performed even above and beyond. You know what I mean? I'm like, oh, okay. I'm not necessarily buying all of it. And again, she does it extremely well. There's just something about, and I'm not sure if this has come up in your other conversations, but there's something I've talked about with people in the past, is that, like, the one thing that is so core to pop that is not core to the Taylor proposition is hypersexuality. I'm not praising nor criticizing her. It's just an observation that so much of pop spectacle is so intimately tied up with sexuality. And there is something about Taylor performing this choreography that is obviously meant to connote sexuality. And it just doesn't really, like, the plug is not completely reaching the outlet for me at those moments. And it takes me out of the moment. And I find myself literally thinking I'm watching a performance of somebody trying to perform a sexual pop performance. Those moments, the show kind of frayed for me.
I think this is something we've come back to over and again with Taylor, and is actually something that came up a little bit on Deluxe this week. We were talking about Doja Cat, and Doja Cat being a pop star who is, number one, uniquely attuned to, like, the current pop moment in terms of the style of music she makes and the particular talents that requires. People can be talented in other ways, but the particular talents of that, but also, like, attuned to the condition of contemporary stardom and understanding that, like, this kind of at a slight remove, not sweaty, not like that. That's all a bit of a fallacy. And Doja Cat is just like, I'm not buying that, and I'm not delivering that, and I'm not selling that.
No, she's just filthy and sweaty.
Right. And like, it works. So, like it's the '80s, right? She's like a good old 1980s style pop star, right?
Like a vixen, if you will.
Yes. But like, the Taylor proposition is very different. I guess maybe that didn't strike me as much as it does on record in this setting, because there is something a little bit inherently stiff about performing for 70,000 people. Like, you're really doing the least that does the most. You disagree. You think it's the opposite.
I do think it's the opposite, but I was going to say, this is where I point out that I really wish you had seen Renaissance.
Yes. No, I as do I. And maybe I will be able to get to it before the end of the fall.
It achieves, like, a lot of those things. I mean, listen, I've seen Madonna, not in stadiums, but I've seen Madonna in arenas for many, many years. And obviously, sexuality plays a very different role in her music and her, her entire conceit. But... And as rehearsed as she is, because she is, much like Taylor, a perfectionist, and you know that every move on that tour is very rehearsed. Madonna, bless you. You better be practicing right now for the Celebration
Karen's
World
coming.
Tour.
Karen's
I am
coming.
On my way. But anyway, I mean, two people I admire very much for their work ethics and their exceptional practice. There is something less performative about Madonna's on a grand stage enacting that kind of a narrative.
I mean, obviously these are proactive conscious choices, but do you think that there's a version of this tour for Taylor at this age, at this career moment, like in the arc, where a thing that you're referring to would be more viable, something that leaned into a certain kind of maturity, physicality, etc.? Is that something that Taylor could pull off? Because I think if we look back to the Reputation tour, which is probably, like, the closest to this that you're closest to what you're talking about, the awkwardnesses in that tour were probably in the moments that you're theoretically describing.
Yeah. Also, I mean, like, she did enact a lot of, like, anti-Kanye energy and rage on stage on that tour, which was also a little, I don't know, it just felt like those were the moments where this show went a little bit left. It was like, do we have to do this?
Yes, for the future book writers among us. Yes, you do. You do have to do that.
Yes.
We appreciate it.
I mean, listen, it's tough because, again, this was, like, obviously it's such an impressive show at such an impressive scale. She's 33. I do wonder how many more years of this kind of pop performance she's going to want to do.
This came up last week.
Oh, that's interesting. But I think she could play a stadium into her 60s, honestly. Just people really want to hear the songs and they really wanted to commune. I mean, that was such a huge part of it. I didn't leave there with people murmuring in my ear, oh my God, you remember the choreography from Delicate or whatever? It's like, that's not what people are taking away from the tour. They're taking away the camaraderie and the bracelets and the experience and the, you know, we're all in it togetherness. And the fact that she sounded really good and they heard the songs that they loved.
To your point from a second ago about she can play stadiums for 25, 30 more years, I think this came up with Wesley last week. We were talking about like Taylor at her peak, whether if this is her peak or whatever. And I actually felt, I feel like her commercial peak and creative peak is actually gone. Like we're past that moment, or at least not that she couldn't peak again. But if you're looking at like sort of in literally just these, you know, 10 albums or whatever. But this might be her peak of crowd drawing, her peak of the intersection of her desire to do something that's this big statement with the opportunity to do it, with the pent up fan demand from 3 years of COVID and pandemic. I don't know if she's ever going to do a stadium tour like this again. Like she might do a stadium tour like a Springsteen or like an Ed Sheeran or something. But I don't know if she'll do this again. This might be the peak of whatever this is. And she may well be doing stadium tours for 25 more years, but I don't know that we'll see a spectacle quite like this again.
I think that's true. I can see that.
But do you think, like, I'm actually not sure that harms her. If anything, I think it might be better suited to do a more restrained stadium level tour. That might be better suited to the skill set.
I agree with that. But I think even just for optics, she can't come out with anything anywhere near like this in the next 5 years, because if it makes 1 billion instead of 1.5 billion, it will be seen as a failure. And she's not a person who will be seen as a failure. So if I was a betting woman, which, by the way, you all know that I am, I would say that her next round of tour
is like, take it to AC, Gans.
Well, I would imagine her next tour is going to be like Intimate Rooms, singer-songwriter. You know what I mean? Just so it can't possibly be compared. But and on this note, another thing about the tour, which I'm not sure if came up in your other conversations, was like the unbelievable command of PR that shout out Tree Payne and Taylor always have held throughout this entire tour. There were there were a handful of moments, particularly at the beginning of the tour, that really threatened to topple this apple cart. The ticket sale calamity, which she came off completely unscathed, as though she had nothing to do with it. I don't have facts. I don't know if she did or not. I'm just saying it was remarkable the way in which it was deflected squarely onto Ticketmaster.
Yeah.
Maddie Healy, for like 2 weeks, it was all anybody could think about. I had teens actually saying to me, yes, I do know teens, do we continue to support her? This is lunacy. You know, I don't know what she's doing. They dispense with him like he did not even feel the door hitting him on the way out.
I literally, when you said that, I was like, did they date? I had like a brief moment of total, like I got like Men in Blacked. Yeah. I got like Will Smith Men in Black. Someone held the thing to my head and erased my memory.
There was one where she was like chatting with her dad. I mean, this was all the headlines. They dispensed with this so quickly and immediately just continued to turn the narrative onto the things they could control, which were absolutely brilliant. Two surprise songs every night. What are they going to be? You've created a news moment every single night of the tour. You create more of them. You invite people on stage. Taylor Lautner in Kansas City the night Ben Cesario happened to be there reporting. Yeah. Because the video featuring him happens to come out. Just absolutely brilliant chess for however many dates, over 50 dates. The stamina for that alone is truly unreal, just absolutely unreal. Like a feat unlike I could have fathomed.
Hire Karen Gans for your PR consultations. Just like,
I don't know if really everything assess I said today is going to qualify,
but we see the Matrix in the truest sense. Like we see all the behind them, like, and we salute. Let's talk a little bit about the music.
Oh, is it time to go, Pedro? Is it time to go up? My God.
No, but let's talk a little bit about the music. Obviously, to your point, she sounded really good. I had the benefit of seeing opening night. So, you know, voice like really just primed, ready to go. Were there parts of the set list of the tour? I agree, like the jumbling of the eras is a little I know why they did it. I understand, because it's like you can't make it that linear. It's overly narrativized. But were there moments that you felt like, yes, this is truly peak Taylor? And were there moments where you're like, I could have left this at home?
I mean, John, it was 3 hours and 45 minutes long. I bless Taylor and her exceptionally deep catalog, but like Madonna is not playing even in her younger age. At 3 hours and 45 minutes, I think there is an art to leaving them wanting more, even though I also respect that she was trying to give people as much bang for their considerable buck. You know, it was thoughtful.
Yes.
In some ways, but it was exhausting in others, which is truly how I find Taylor, thoughtful and exhausting. So it matched. But again, there were moments when a song would strike up. I didn't look at the set list that closely in advance. I usually do. I just was like, I didn't want to completely ruin it for myself. There were moments when songs struck up and I was like, oh my God, she's a genius. So she opens with Miss Americana. That's my favorite song from that record. I was extremely excited, but it was abbreviated and I was angry. So that was my first response. I was like, damn it, don't do that. I was ready for it. When we hit the Reputation part of the show, I got exceptionally excited. I thought that it was flawless.
Those songs sound so good. They aged well. They didn't age badly, even though they still don't make sense in the actual specific moment. As much as I like the record, they age really well.
Yeah.
They've held up.
She picked good ones from that record, too. I thought those were all amazing. Don't Blame Me. It's one of my absolute favorites from that album. I was like losing it. Very excited. I was like, you know, wow. Trouble. I did not need the 10-minute version of All Too Well.
Oh, I like that, but I know what you mean.
10 minutes.
I think it's okay. It's fine. It's fine.
It was long. Blank Space.
Yep.
Bad Blood. Yeah. Actually, when she got to Bad Blood, I think I had chills. And I was like, how did she do this? It was so late in the show. At that point, I was like very drained. And I was like, she was also, by the way, just stamina-wise, did not flag. Just truly, truly in peak form.
Yeah, really. She gets her steps in.
Unbelievable. Antihero, my favorite of her recent singles, was really excited for that. And then My Show was the one where Jack came out and they did Getaway Car.
Oh, right.
And I, you know, almost my spirit left my body briefly. I was very excited to hear my favorite song. But there was also a sort of like a weird thing with Ice Spice at that show where she obviously was supposed to come out and do Karma with her, but instead she seemed to be delayed or something. So they debuted the video for Karma and then Ice Spice came out again. So I heard Karma like three times during that show, and I was like, as much as I like the song, and I really do, it was a bit much.
What song should we go out with? What are we going to do? Getaway Car?
Let us hear Getaway Car, the studio version.
Getaway Mazda.
Getaway Mazda, stuck in the MetLife parking lot.
Literally, the no Getaway Mazda. Karen Gans, as always.
Thank you, John. People salute can't emoji. See that you're saluting.
Salute emoji.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
We are back. Taylor Swift Eras Tour Popcast Speed Round Part 2. Even Taylor herself can't get enough of the Eras Tour with the recent film announcement. We are joined now. It's Verinda Jagoda. Verinda, welcome. First time on Popcast. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's very exciting. So Verinda is a freelance writer, has written for Pitchfork and many other places, wrote about Taylor for Pitchfork. You just told me something a minute ago, which I just think, like, in the interests of full disclosure, probably you should lead with.
Yeah, I am a Taylor Swift kind of historian of sorts. I wrote my college thesis about her, about the
way her fans... graduated college, just for...
I did graduate okay. college.
They did not stop you. They did not stop you at the stage. They weren't like... It wasn't like that.
Okay. It wasn't like that. I did get, you know, I got warned by my thesis advisor. She was like, I don't know how they're going to take this. They're not, but it was, it went great. I wrote about...
What's the thesis of the thesis?
The thesis of the thesis. So, okay, granted, this was 2015. So it was a little bit of a different kind of poptimism space.
Oh, wow. This was, yeah. Talk about four letter words. Jeez. Yeah.
This was maybe before poptimism was so as mainstream as it is now. It was like at the, you know, as it was increasing. So I kind of was like arguing that young girls are kind of fans of pop stars are seen as kind of complicit in their own marginalization by pop music or whatever, but they're actually like very active in their consumption. And so I looked at a lot of fan Instagrams and I analyzed fan Instagrams and how they kind of, you know, they make art based off Taylor Swift. And I was like, they're artists themselves. This is real art. They make friends. They like, you know, like I talked about the Selenators and the Swifties and how they combine forces on Instagram. They'll lift each other up and, you know, things like that. Also a different time for fandom, I would say.
Yes,
now,
I was going to say, yeah, before the dark era.
Exactly. At this point, I feel like when I tell people I'm a Swiftie, I have to kind of specify. I'm like, I...
What vintage Swiftie you are? Yeah. 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 Totally yeah. Fair. No. Okay. So Eras Tour, how many Taylor tours you've been to? Eras is which one? What number?
This is my fourth one. I've been okay. Since Red. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. You went where? You went here at MetLife?
No, I flew to Denver for this.
Wow. Yeah. What's jagging in Denver? Okay, any particular reason for Denver? Or just like that was a place to go?
That was the only place I could get tickets. So I went, yeah.
Wow. Dedication. Okay, tell me a little bit about what you knew about the show before actually going into the building.
I went with my best friend, who's also a huge Swiftie, and we've been friends since, you know, middle school, and we've been Swifties basically since then. And she knew everything. She knew the set list. She knew like all the transitions, whatever. I was kind of trying to keep it a surprise to a degree.
Yeah,
keep it fresh. But you know, of course, I'm on TikTok, so I'm seeing the TikTok. So I knew what the outfits looked like. I knew to make friendship bracelets. I knew about the lore. I didn't know the specifics of, you know, what the different eras would be like, what the order would be, or like anything like that.
In your prior three experiences, did you have sort of like an ordinal ranking of how these tours have gone? In your mind, are they consistently getting better? Do you feel like there are peaks and valleys thus far?
That's a great question. I mean, this one is like clearly the best of any of them. The other three, I would say, were pretty similar to me. I mean, I like love Red. That's like my favorite Taylor album. So obviously that tour was like kind of special to me on a personal level. But I think that to me, it's like those three were the three before that I went to before this one were kind of the same. And then this one was like just totally different.
This tour is clearly the most narrativized of all the tours. And I think in the moment of the prior tours, they might have felt more narrativized than they actually were. I think in the rear view, they feel very much like they feel like capsules, but they sometimes, I don't know if reluctant is the right word, but I feel like they feel very promotional of the specific point of view of the moment in which the tour takes place, connected to the album or connected to the, heaven forbid, the era in its real time. This obviously is a taking stock moment. It's also, you know, to my eye and ear, it's a little bit of how do we reckon with the fact that we haven't toured three albums and two of those albums sound one way and the third one sounds a totally different way. And then there's a fourth one that's going to sound some different way. It does feel like that's the conundrum that the Eras Tour is trying to solve. And it solves it by actually going more ambitious and saying, well, let's take stock of the whole thing. What do you feel like the story that Taylor is trying to tell about her career by taking this approach at this age? Like, you could argue that this is an approach that someone takes in their 40s or their 50s. You know, she's far from that. What do you think it's saying that she's taking this approach now?
That is a good point, because like, why is she doing this now? I was, you know, before going, I was kind of like, isn't every tour an Eras Tour? Like, aren't you always just playing songs from your whole catalog? But I think, I mean, it ties into the way that she's kind of like revisiting past selves through the re-records project too. I think those two things are very connected at this moment in her career. honestly, she was just going stir crazy after the pandemic and like just wanted to do it big. I always kind of laugh when I listen to The Lakes, where I'm like, that is not true, Taylor. I don't think you want to go to The Lakes. I think you want to be a pop star forever. So I think that this is just part of it is just that. It's like she's just been like, she just wants to kind of do it big. But I think you mentioned this maybe in the last episode, she's found this kind of aesthetic, this, you know, so much of a tour is the aesthetic. And she's found this really interesting moment and aesthetic that works, like where I feel like, I don't know, she's not really an aesthetically focused person.
Studiously unaesthetic, but yeah. Careful, not casual, thought through, right. But not over-designed.
She's not a style icon. She's not like a Rihanna. Like, no one's like looking at her outfits being like, I want to try to recreate a Taylor Swift outfit.
Although, I'm sorry, some fans are,
but I personally am not. But what she is really good at is self-mythologizing, you know, and she's always been really good at that. And, you know, sometimes you see with a boy band or a girl group, like each member has a distinct personality and she does all of them. And they do that so that there's different ways to access the band. And she like keeps trying to give fans different ways to access her. And she's, you know, kind of described herself as this like pathological people pleaser. And so this tour, I think, is like really just in this moment where she just really wants to self-mythologize and give us all these ways to access her and give the fans all these different avenues to be a Taylor Swift fan.
I personally get skeptical when people... pop stars start talking about fan service and I'm doing this for, I get skeptical, but I do feel with Taylor sometimes some of the artistic motivation is quite literally to feed a particular vibration of fan energy. And I don't know if other, like you mentioned Rihanna, like I don't know if Rihanna is doing that. I don't know if Beyonce is doing, I think from that, for those stars, it's a little bit more top down. We're coming up with an idea, a visual, a concept. We're going to pass it off to the fans and the fans will do whatever they do with it. Whereas, at least to my eye, Taylor seems to anticipate the fans a little bit more, or it's woven into her, to the thought process. Does that scan for you?
Yes. I mean, I think it started with the clues, you know, since the clues about what each song is about. And since then, it's just kind of like really blown up. Since that era, like she's really obsessed with what her fans think about her. And I think like that's also like kind of what the music, I mean, she wants you to, she takes the deeply personal and makes it so universal. And I think that ties into the way she's obsessed with the fans' kind of personal narratives. It's all about really feeling this deep personal connection with Taylor. Like you're supposed to feel like she's doing this for you specifically. And your memory of whatever 2 a.m. thing is what she's talking about.
Right. Even right. Exactly. That's it. That's a good way to put it. This she's almost like using her stories and songs to incept into you some sense of self or ownership, or the claiming takes place in the fan. It's not, again, not top down in that same way with other folks. That's interesting. Tell me a little bit about what jumped out at you at the show. Like, what were the moments that really felt the most effective? And perhaps by contrast, which parts were you like, this is not the era. I'm not into this era.
So there's two things that I've been really thinking about with the Eras Tour that really stick out to me. So one thing is the dressing up. I think that is something, and that's not, you know, that's not her doing, but like the fans dressing up is like, the fans dressing up, yeah, is something that is so unique. It's never happened before. Like I got there and I felt like I was on a campus. Like I felt it brought this kind of sense of unity. It was interesting. I felt like I was at Taylor Swift University, like the Thursday before Halloween. Like it's just interesting because again, as I was saying, she's not, at least for me, she's not like my fashion icon, but I was so excited to dress up. I wanted to dress like an era. I wanted to dress like the folklore era. And I think that's like just an interesting.
Is that what you did? You did dress up like.
Yeah, I did. Specifically, I dressed up as the song Ivy. Like I literally just bought a bunch of fake Ivy at Michael's and I just like wore it. Like, which I think speaks to like, it was not a good outfit. I would never wear that outfit anywhere, but it was like kind of a really fun way to engage with the music. And I think that was one of my most like favorite parts of being there was like me and my friend who were there. We had like nosebleed seats, but we were just like looking around. We saw someone wearing this like insane, like head to toe pink sequin outfit. And we were like, oh my God, she won. Like she won. And I've just been thinking about, it's been this like summer of dressing up, Barbie movie. Like
it's IRL memedom is really what it is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And then it like, you know, it goes back online because I, you know, when I was thinking of these outfits, the first thing I thought was like, where am I going to post these pictures of myself? But yeah, and even if you like, there's a lot of, if you go on a lot of websites, they'll have a section on their website of like, here are outfits for Renaissance. I've seen websites that have like outfits for Eras Tour. Like, it's interesting. So that's one thing that stood out to me. This other thing I've been thinking about related to the tour, and this is maybe a little bit less like my experience of being at the tour, but I've just, this is related to the Eras Tour, is this kind of healing narrative that the fans are obsessed with right now related to Taylor. And so, you know, she kind of, it was announced that she went through this breakup, like at the, towards the beginning of the tour. Now it's been a few months or whatever. And fans are really obsessed with mashing together videos of her doing the same, performing the same song, like right after the breakup was announced versus now. So like Cornelia Street or whatever it is. And like, they'll do these like very specific readings of her facial gestures. And they'll be like, she was devastated in the first clip. Now she's healed. And I'm like, okay, first of all, this was a 6-year relationship. As far as we know, you don't heal in 2 months from that. Also, we don't know the specifics of what's going on. And so it's interesting, but fans are kind of obsessed with this linear narrative. Like, okay, it's been 2 months. She's healed. This tour has healed her. And it's also happening with the re-records, with the 1989 re-record, because she's kind of talked about in the past, she's talked about she had an eating disorder at the time, and she's, and they're like, oh, she looked so sad. And so there's this narrative that she, just by a function of existing and time, is now this empowered person. And I'm sure, you know, I'm sure that is true in plenty of ways, but it's like this really weird kind of like moment where, because at the same time in her music, I would say she talks about her depression. She also has talked about, well, this is in 2019, but she talked about she doesn't go to therapy. So she's like, my mom's my therapist. And then also in her music, she's kind of grappling with these like really negative emotions, or like just nuance. Like she's really gotten rid of the idea of happy endings in her work. So as her work is getting really mature and nuanced in that way, fans, as it relates to the tour and to the re-records, are really clinging onto this idea that she's healed and she's like revisiting her work, or she's touring now as this like healed person. And I'm just like really interested in why those two things are happening at the same time. Like, it feels like they're almost in opposition to each other.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I haven't really been seeing that as much, but that to me, I wonder if that's a reflection of Taylor having, frankly, several micro generations of fans, and the type of people who are likely to be TikTok forward or Talmudic in that way of comparing one version of the text to the other, maybe are, I say this affectionately, younger, maybe the less mature. They're not as grown and they haven't lived as much, and they're more inclined to impose a narrative onto Taylor that's buttoned up tight. You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about Taylor's music tending less towards resolution. And I wonder, how does that go hand in hand? Or is that in itself in opposition to this kind of magnum opus tour document, which seems to want to say, I am telling one big narrative about my life? But I think in your read, and I think this read is right, the songs themselves do not resolve as cleanly. They're not as pointed as the songs of 5 to 10 years ago. And that's okay. Like, people, one of the things I certainly know, being an elderly person, is you're way less sure of the things that you think you're supposed to be sure of. And retroactively, the things that you know you used to be sure of, you know, are 100% BS. You were wrong more often than not on those. And I'm sure Taylor's hitting that in her life. How does that square with making a big statement like this tour-wise? But also, I'd love to tie it to the re-records and to the bonus materials on the re-records. Tell me a little bit about your thoughts on that.
I feel like there's just a lot of different Taylors kind of in opposition. There's the
all
Taylor
at the same time.
All at the same time. So there's Taylor, the songwriter, who is writing about her emotions, who has this very mature and nuanced take that, you know, the more I kind of live, the less I know. You know, the greatest films of all time are over now. Like, life is hard and there's happiness because of you and happiness after you, like whatever, all of those things. But then there's also Taylor, the businesswoman, who is a ruthless businesswoman and wants to be a billionaire. You know, like, she wants to become a billionaire from this tour, I think.
Me too, girl.
And then, you know, there's so many different Taylors. I don't know which one is the real one, like how she squares away kind of this emotional nuance. And then, oh, the other thing is that I was going to say is there's Taylor the feminist, which is so interesting to me, because Taylor the feminist is so lacking nuance, I think. Her feminist politics are so individualized, and it's all about like her narrative and how she is now empowered. So I think for her, this tour is a feminist act, you know, because it's making her money. But yet at the same time, she shows such incredible nuance in the way she can sing about the end of a relationship or something. So yeah, so I think that they are really all in opposition. They're all like, these selves are kind of butting heads right now. And then, like I was saying before, like she has this song about the lakes where she's like, I don't belong. I want to run away. The only thing that matters to me is like my, you know, romance and the lakes. But I don't think that's true. That's not what this tour indicates. And the tour indicates that she wants to be larger than life. Like she wants to be an icon. She wants to be a pop icon.
The last thing that I think we should talk about, and I'm glad that you confessed to getting dressed up and going and embracing your own like true fan self in addition to your journalist hat and critic hat. But I wonder, and this is a bigger question. This is a question like about your experience, but it's actually kind of a bigger question. You know, how do we experience intense fandom as we age? And in what way, what are the parts that you think that you can hold on to at this age, and presumably, you know, a year, 3, 5, 10 years from now, that will survive your natural maturity and skepticisms, and you know, you can identify parts of the catalog or parts of the presentation that don't hold up, whether it's aesthetics or politics or whatever, but you still hold a certain core of devotion. What is it that allows that core of devotion to remain, do you think? Because that's something that I think we'll probably be reckoning with 5 to 10 years from now as we see Stan armies and folks who are in those spaces grow up and move out into the world in different, more complicated ways. How do you experience, it as tug of war, as productive tension? Do you see the skepticism as like a central tenet of extreme fandom? Not the extreme fandom, but you know what I mean? Yeah. But like, how do you experience those things side by side? Are they like butting, they fighting? Are they in rhythm?
There's two things. The first is that there's the broader context of, I was talking about like poptimism and stuff and how my fandom has sometimes felt in relation to that. I think when I started out as a Taylor Swift fan, I felt like it was my whole personality because I felt like no one got it about pop music or whatever, you know, when I was in high school or something. I felt like such a need to like really double down on being a fan because I felt like people thought less of me because I like pop music. At this point, culturally, I don't think that people really think that way in the same way. Poptimism has just kind of made it such that like that feels like an outdated kind of like hard stance to take. So I felt less of a need to like really claim this identity in that way. So that's one thing. But the other thing, just in terms of just, you're talking about just getting older and stuff. I think of it as like the kind of like exploding brain meme, whatever, you know, the galaxy brain meme. Yeah. Where like first, I think I just kind of really identified with everything. And I like, you know, I just blindly accepted what she sang about as, you know, as my narrative. And then I had this moment, which was also, you know, 2017 identity politics moment for me was very big, you know. And I had this moment where I was like, oh my God, Taylor could never understand me. I'm a brown woman. She's a white woman. Like, how could I ever relate to this? And then I think now I have a more live and let live kind of mentality about it that actually allows me to access her work where I'm like, I know who she is. Like, she is a blonde billionaire. She does not actually speak to my blonde
billionaire. Yeah, she got to name her next album Blonde Billionaire. She got to name her next album Blonde. That's it. It's done. Tree, make the call.
Honestly, I would wear that on a t-shirt. That would be good merch, right?
I might just make that t-shirt. Yeah, like, we got to make like a bootleg rap style t-shirt, Taylor Swift, Blonde Billionaire. Yeah, I'm making a note. Also, if anybody wants to mock that up real fast and do a quick limited run, popcastnetwhitetimes.com, just, or DM me probably. Don't put it on at my times. Just DM me.
Blonde Billionaire. But so I think at this point I have understood the limits of who she is. And I've learned to not have such a like close tie. And, you know, I think that is just kind of maturing, is like letting people be who they are and accepting them for who they are. And just being like, yeah, she, you know, there are elements of what she sings about that I find that are extremely resonant, but I don't have to like, I don't have to cancel her for being who she is just because like, she's never not, she's never going to be anything other than that. And I also don't want her, I remember reading an essay, I think it was a Ta-Nehisi Coates essay about girls, actually, when it came out. And, you know, it, girls had, you know, rightfully faced a lot of criticism.
Oh, yeah.
But he wrote this great piece that was like, yeah, obviously this show is like super white and has problems with how they try to talk about race. But this is not the show. We don't want Lena Dunham telling the stories of people of color. She would not do a good job with it. Just let her kind of be who she is and then do the work of finding the people who are telling those stories in a compelling way and elevating those people. Don't ask Lena Dunham to be the voice of everyone, because that's like not, that doesn't make sense. And so that's how I feel about Taylor.
It's unfair and short-sighted.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And it, like, you know, it ignores what she does do well, and it kind of just not the way that it doesn't make sense. It's a, and so like, I feel the same way about Taylor Swift, kind of, where I'm like, I don't expect her to, you know, be my like South Asian queen, you know, like she's not going to.
I'm going to hope not.
you know, she can't do that. And so anyway, so all of that is to say my fandom has, I have, because I'm able to just let her be who she is, I feel like I'm able to enjoy it more and like just let it be what it is and not expect her to fulfill every kind of musical need for me.
So as we go out, I guess, what's a Taylor song that hits you still in that pure place where you can still, you know, the young me and the old me can like shake hands on this particular moment in Taylorology?
Man, first thing that comes to mind for me is Ivy, which is funny because it's a narrative, it's a made up story, but it just, I just think the songwriting is so beautiful. And I love that kind of like the guitar work on it. I think it's one of the most, the best songs she's ever written. And the longing, and I just, you know, I love the longing in that song. I think it's just a work of genius.
Great. Let's get it cracking. Verinda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets, and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in LA, binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
We are back for the third and final segment of the Taylor Swift Eras Tour Speed Round Popcast Part 2. Josh Duboff is here. Josh, first time on pop? Or were you on like 1 week that I was away?
I know. I don't know if this tech, there's an asterisk, I feel, because it was
snuck on.
You were off that week and Joe hosted the Ariana Grande episode.
Yeah. This
is my first John episode.
That's canon. That's yes, right. It's first canon important episode. Yeah. Okay. Glad we settled that. Josh is a freelance writer. For many years, a senior writer of Vanity Fair. Josh, where did you see the Eras Tour? Talk to us.
I saw her three times. I saw her at, it was over Memorial Day weekend at MetLife Stadium, New York, New Jersey. I saw her again in end of July at Levi's Stadium in San Francisco. And then the final time I saw her was actually the first LA show. So about a week after the San Francisco show. So three times in total.
Okay. So let's ask, before we get to the sort of minutia.
Yeah.
When you saw the first show, did you know you were going to see multiple, or did you choose to see multiple based on the experience of the first one?
I knew I was seeing her at least one more time when I saw her in New York. So I knew it wasn't necessarily going to be a one and, you know, that was my only time. But it was interesting. Well, we'll talk more about it, but it was interesting to see it multiple times because I do feel like it changed a lot in certain ways from New York to the West Coast. So it's, in some ways it feels like I saw two different shows, oddly.
Before we get into that, I'm curious, we talked a lot last week and a little bit this week about crowds and audiences. Tell me a little bit about distinctions you might have seen between those three places. We haven't had anybody who's gone to San Francisco, but I wonder what you're seeing in the audience and if it was meaningfully different in any of the places.
I talked to another friend of mine who saw just New York and LA also, and I had this, a similar feeling as him, which was that the LA crowd felt slightly more, and it's funny, my friend was saying maybe it was the roof actually, because the LA show, SoFi Stadium, where I'd never been before, has a roof, which obviously MetLife Stadium didn't have here. It felt like a slightly less just all out, Swifty, you know, it might have been the specific night I was there, but the MetLife show I was at was just like wild, fanatic fans who were just losing their minds to every song, shrieking. The LA crowd felt like, obviously still, a Taylor Swift show is always going to have kind of, you know, the decibel levels are high, you know, the Illicit Affairs, everyone's up and like screaming their lungs out. But I think, yeah, the LA crowd, maybe because of the like sceney celebrity, I don't know what exactly the elements were, the roof, there's maybe a few different things at play. It didn't feel quite as like all out the way that the New York show had sort of that rabid fan energy to it.
I also wonder if in some way, because it was so much later in the summer, most people knew what they were going to. Whereas I think in New York, obviously it wasn't the first week or the second week, but there were still a lot of people who I think weren't totally plugged in. Like I remember like going to the opener, obviously you don't know what you're going to get, but I just think there are a lot of people who kind of don't pay attention to tours in general until they get to a major city, not to denigrate whatever cities, including the great city of Phoenix, where I went. But I think sometimes it takes a while for internet discourse to catch up. And, you know, the New York shows are always going to be over-indexed as far as like how they're represented. And I wonder if by the time it got to LA, everybody who was there knew the set list, knew the gestures, had seen TikToks or YouTubes or Instagrams of the event, and kind of maybe weren't quite as surprised. I wonder.
I think that's possible. I think there was obviously so much, I know you guys have talked about this, but just like TikTok, Instagram, there's so much content of, you know, I feel like you had seen so many of the key moments. Most people, especially going who are Swift fans, had seen this stuff before they got to the show. I was almost describing it, not that I've actually been to a Rocky Horror Picture Show screening myself, but there was something I was picking. There was something I was picking up on where the way that people, you know, show up to those, as I understand it, you know, in costume, the call and response nature of seeing Rocky Horror. There was something where, you know, the Taylor Swift show has those same call and response moments that people knew from the TikToks. They're wearing the costumes, the friendship bracelet trading, I know where the celebrity tent is from the TikToks I've watched. I know where she's going to look during, you know, Tolerate It. Like people just really are, as you said, like fully prepared, especially the LA show after a whole summer of TikTok content.
So it's both like reactive, but also participatory.
Yes. Yeah,
because it's interesting, by the end of the tour, I imagine for sure people understand what their jobs are, as opposed to the first few weeks of a tour where it's like not quite clear what the job of the fan is.
I'm going to completely contradict what I said about the LA show being like cooler, because I do feel like actually in San Francisco and LA, I did see exactly what you're saying. People came in just knowing that set list like by heart. I saw so many more kind of like, it's time for like Folklore is coming next. Like the way people just like knew exactly what was going to be happening in New York, probably for what the reason you're explaining, you know, you're saying that like it was earlier on, people just weren't quite as familiar with the contours of the show and sort of how she was putting it all together, did feel a little bit less like that.
No, that's fascinating. I think actually it has quite a lot to say about the nature of contemporary live performance at this scale, which is you have to find ways to essentially make the show live in the phones of the people who show up. And for a performer like Taylor, she's going to bake that into the show presentation through gestural choices, through transitions, choreography, etc. But it's going to take some time before the fans fully understand, like, okay, this is what's transmittable about the show. But I imagine, like I said, by the San Francisco and LA shows, people understood.
People got their job. People knew their job.
They understood the assignments, as it were.
I'm sure others have talked about this, but the surprise song decision to kind of do those two songs every night that were unique to that specific show, I feel like that was really smart. I started to know at a certain time every night, if I logged on to, you know, I guess, what do we call it now? X.
Yeah.
If I logged on, I would see what the surprise, you know, I was always curious. I always want, you know, it creates this sense that it's less of a, it's like we're in this all in this kind of like shared community together where you're kind of like picking up on what song she's going to do each night. I thought that was a really kind of interesting. I know other acts have done similar things, but I feel like the way she employed that was really, really worked well to make each show feel like its own specific thing, even if you were seeing it multiple times or if you felt like you knew the whole show from, you know, your feed, you still felt like there was something that was only yours that you could hold on to.
And it builds the lore.
Yes, yes. I was there for I Can See You. Like the way you could like talk about the song you got to see felt very special and unique. I liked that a lot as a choice she made.
I'm curious about what you said earlier about feeling that the show changed from the East Coast to the West Coast. Tell me a little bit about that, because I've only seen it just the one time, so I haven't had a chance to.
John, we got to get you to Europe.
My ticket.
I've got you 3-1. I'm killing you right now.
Who's sugaring me?
Okay, so you've actually probably seen these. I know you're a TikTok guy. There's a few I've seen where it's specific moments from the show where it's, I think, even actually from Phoenix or Vegas, like early on versus the West Coast, the San Francisco, LA. It'll be like the vigilante shit moment, you know, where she's on the chair. You kind of see it both ways. I think there was another I saw that might have been from the Folklore section. But like, it's actually kind of wild how marked the difference is. And I think it was something I saw anyway, just there was a level of like sass or assuredness and definitely confidence, but like also just there was sort of a different, in the same way that we're saying that like the fans knew what to expect, it felt like she just really was owning the show in the California shows I saw, that it was like, this was her domain, the facial expressions, the everything was a little bit heightened, I felt. And I don't know if that's just the like, how this is, I mean, you've seen so many more concerts than I have, if that always happens as like a tour goes on, but
often it could be the opposite because things get rote. And, yes. And by show 30,
you're like, oh, I can do this in my sleep. Yeah. And it felt, and you're right. Yeah. It felt the opposite of that. It did feel to me like, and maybe there was like a certain energy. I do know that the first three nights, I think, of the LA shows were being filmed for, I guess, actually what ended up being the movie that's coming.
Yes, there's going to be a movie. Yeah.
So actually the LA night.
We all got to have film night.
By the way, there definitely needs to be a podcast era.
We should do that, right?
Event, yeah. I'll be an honorary organizer of that if you want.
Okay, I'm gonna say it now. We're gonna do Taylor Eras Tour. Maybe we'll figure out a screening or something. I'm literally making this up as I go, but we're gonna figure it out. How did I not think of that till literally just now? Okay, we're gonna do it. This is how we know we're gonna do it. I have these small post-it notes. I'm gonna write on this post-it note, and it's going to live on my desk, Eras Tour film screening. This is literally how it got done. Anything I've ever done in life started like this. Eras Tour screening. Okay, good. We're doing it.
We're selling that sticky on eBay at some point.
More info, TK. But anyway, sorry. Please pick that up.
Yeah, so I think there was a sort of added, there's also something, my brother had sent me a tweet that was like, as I was walking into the LA show, that like the fans had already picked up that the light up bracelets, you know, that they give you when you walk in.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
That they were different for the shows that were being filmed.
Oh, yeah, interesting.
I don't know if this is like I'm breaking news here.
Tree's fine. Tree's not gonna worry about it.
But I think the light up bracelets were like operating in a completely different way. There was sort of an added, there was like a little bit of a, oh, this is being, I don't know, we were part of something that we all kind of could see the cameraman on stage running around to film her. I felt like maybe that was adding some sort of like energy to the whole thing too. I know the last night of LA, she announced obviously the 1989 Taylor's version. So I feel like she also finds ways kind of to keep it fresh maybe for herself. I think there were like a lot of celebrities at the LA shows that she probably knew. I don't know. I feel like there was added things that were kind of keeping it exciting for her. I can't believe that this tour goes on to what, the end of 2024? I'm curious to have this conversation. I mean, I don't know if I'll be seeing any more. And I'm curious to see those TikToks of like what it then looks like a year from now. I mean, it's a wild amount of time to me that like she's going to keep doing this show.
I feel sometimes when artists are on the road at this level, you're really living in that material. And how much of a challenge is it, might you imagine, for her to continue to make new, fresh? I don't know if she's going to put out a new record or et cetera. Is there something trapped in amber about being on a tour like this for that long? I wonder about that. I don't know the answer.
I hardly know what I'm doing like in 2 weeks. So I do feel like it's crazy to have your life. I think this was in, I might be confusing pop star documentaries. God knows there's a lot of them now. But there was one of them where if it was Taylor or someone else, it was like everything is scheduled for the next. I think it was Taylor. Everything's scheduled for the next like three. Like that does feel like almost antithetical to the like spontaneity of life that you would think an artist is trying to like foster and you know would want to be like a core aspect of their day to day. Meanwhile, she knows where she's going to be on like August 27th of 2025. But I think Harry Styles is maybe was similar, but like the way that they did it where she has like her weekends in the city and then has those kind of weeks where you would see her like at Electric Lady Suit, like she was like going out, seeing Gigi Hadid, like doing her thing during the week. Felt slightly more to me like I was seeing, like I feel like sometimes you've seen artists on tour and like you never see them, but like it felt like she was still out and about more.
But this is the advantage of being number one, incredibly successful, number two, incredibly wealthy. This is something I've learned over the past several years, like keeping eyes on stadium tours, particularly these artists are incredibly successful and incredibly wealthy. Really what you're seeing is they're private jetting in on Friday or maybe for a Friday show or Thursday night for a Friday show. Maybe there's two shows and then they're private jetting absolutely away. Like it's not like a classic tour where you get on the bus or if you're a little bit better off, you're taking smaller flights from somewhere in the Midwest to somewhere else in the Midwest. Taylor, the minute the show is over, Saturday night or Sunday night, there is a truck waiting to take her directly to the airport. If someone wants to fact check me, you're welcome to fact check me, but this is right. To go wherever she wants to go. And if that's back home, if that's back to Nashville, it's to LA, it's to New York, it's to somewhere else. That's how these tours are structured. That's how the current Morgan Wallen tour more or less is structured. That's how the Ed Sheeran tour. You see this like current Ed Sheeran tour where it's like he's doing like weird, like I'm serving drinks at a bar in like rural, like a Boston suburb, you know, like just like adding things on. That's a very particular thing. And it actually takes touring almost out of the realm of like unbearable labor and into a kind of like fun thing to do for the weekend. It's like, hey, I spent like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Yeah, I was just catching up with friends, you know, just hanging out. We got matcha, you know, we like did some vintage shopping. Maybe, you know, we went to What Goes Around Comes Around. Maybe we bought some stuff. And then Thursday, oh, yeah, no, I just got to catch a plane to like Austin, you know, just put in two shows real fast. We'll be back. Don't worry about me. I'll be back.
And we'll do dinner. I can probably make a dinner Sunday night.
Yeah, exactly.
Like it does feel livable in a different, on that level, livable in a different way.
That's what I'm trying to get to with podcast.
And I think that made me think what you were just saying about kind of how this Taylor tour, the US leg at least, felt very much like I had a few friends who were like, oh, I'm going to go to like Denver for the weekend and make it into like seeing Taylor Swift on the Friday. Then I'll like go, you know, like I almost made it. And it's not exactly like a festival, but just the 3.5 hours.
Oh, that's interesting.
The kind of fact that it was like city by city, the way
it allows
that, like,
fans to do the same thing.
And I, in fact, my cousin who didn't, is like so mad at me for having seen it three times and she hasn't. She's I'll shout out Julia.
Julia.
Yeah, she's about just starting her senior year of college.
Hey, Julia, sorry. Not sorry.
She's not pleased with me. She's like, you couldn't like figure out a way to get me to one of these three shows. But she is, we were talking about kind of, because like I think, I forget the three cities, Miami, New Orleans, and maybe Indianapolis, one other that Taylor announced for like a year from now, basically in the US. So Julia was like, we were talking about like, maybe she'll pick one of those three weekends, to like go with like her college friends and they'll just like
and turn it
New
into
Orleans
a thing
for a weekend. Yeah, exactly. And I was like, and the way you get the two opening acts and I was like, oh, that actually is, there was something about, we're like, oh, you'll get the hotel for two nights and fly in. Like, it does feel a little bit, I haven't been to like a big music festival, I actually don't think, but like, it felt like that energy to me that like you're going for the weekend.
I think that's a great point. It's a totally different energy from like going to the Garden on a Tuesday night.
Yes.
Where you're like squeezing it in after work.
And you wake up the next morning, you're like, did I see a show last night? Yeah.
That's actually, I think that's a great point and something we haven't talked about, which is the event nature. And the event nature is baked into the fact that it is a weekend thing and that people are doing destination. I think that's totally, totally correct. And it also incentivizes people. If she's playing multiple nights in a city, it potentially incentivizes them to see multiple shows. Because if you're like, well, damn, I just bought a whole ass plane ticket to go to Denver. maybe I'll just go to, not, you know, like you turn it into a whole thing. Oh, I think that's totally right.
I like that a lot. I think it's inventive. It's interesting.
You talked about celebrities earlier and you mentioned it in two different ways. One, you're seeing this kind of like extracurricular Taylor footage of like, oh, hanging out with so-and-so or in between shows hanging out. But then also you point LA rightly is a celebrity hub of people showing up. And I'd be interested. One thing we haven't talked about either last week or this week is where Taylor stands on the kind of like celebrity Maslow's needs hierarchy. Like where is she? And in what way does the tour amplify or shift the kind of vibration of where she sits on that? For me, her being someone who can still draw famous people, like I'm sure all these celebrities have seen Taylor before. It's not like, I mean, maybe some people every now and again, you see some athlete who's just like, well, I just had no idea, you know, like you get something like that. But most celebrities have seen a Taylor tour. She's still drawing them. How does that power play out in terms of her broader celebrity relationships and her place in the celebrity ecosystem?
Maybe partly because they have the celebrity tent that's so visible, which like is right there. And
it's a performance. It's part of the performance in a city like LA, for sure.
It's part of the whole Rocky Horror-ness to me a little bit. Actually, Gigi Hadid really putting in the hours. She was at the San Francisco show I was at. And when she came out, it was almost maybe like maybe 5 minutes before the show was going to start. It was like the Messiah was walking. Like people, all the Swifties like congregated around Gigi Hadid to hand her the bracelets and to kind of like, and it felt like, I have a video I'll send you, John.
I would love to see it.
But there's like everyone, it's like all these fans just congregated around her almost like at an altar, kind of handing her the friendship bracelets. And I was like, wow, this is really wild that like Taylor Swift's like model best friend gets this kind of reaction from the like Taylor Swift fans at her show when she comes out. And they were all, I saw so many people because I had a really good vantage point of Gigi, like filming Gigi, you know, that like kind of like to see how she responded to the different songs and such. I feel like Taylor, I know you guys have said this, like, it's crazy to me that like, this many years into her career, she seems like she's more famous than she's ever been. Like, it actually does feel that way to me that like,
oh,
she's
way like, more famous.
But I thought like, you know, I profiled her, I think it was in 2015. And like, that was the 1989 tour. And I remember at that point thinking like, there's never been a more famous person than this person. And this was, you know, 8 years ago. Now it's, you know, 2015. Yeah. So we're 8 years after that. And it somehow feels like she's even bigger. I think you're right that she still draws. It's like the Super Bowl coming to town. I don't know. There's like just something about the way the celebrities showed up for this US leg where I was like constantly, it was like celebrities you would never even think of in the same like sentence as Taylor Swift, but somehow like, you know, you had like your athletes, your football players. I remember there was like Paul Thomas Anderson was there one night.
Paul Thomas Anderson was there?
Yes, he was there for one of the California shows. You had like, you know, you're like Paul Rudd, James Marsden, like dude actors. You had like, I feel like there were just like all these different genres of celebrity kind of came out for this. Definitely the athletes, you know, other pop stars. I think like Halsey made a whole thing of like wearing all her bracelets and coming. Obviously Carly Kloss going. Like, I think there were just so many. The sheer like tonnage of these like celebrities that showed up, I think, yes, yeah, speaks to like where Taylor stands right now, which is like, I think it's like her and Beyonce, but it's like, I don't know who else can draw this like eclectic sort of like multi-generational. You have like the teenagers coming, you have the like 50-year-olds, you have like Laura Dern coming with her kid, and, you know, in the same booth as like Emma Stone and like Lupita Nyong'o. It's just like, it's like such a kind of like Lupita showed up with Sarah Paulson, I think. Like, this is what I mean. It was like killer. Such a like mix of like,
love it.
It was like a Mad Libs of Met Gala attendees or something.
But
it was
that's
like,
but what's funny about Taylor's, the nature of Taylor's celebrity. If you think I'm wrong, tell me I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'm curious.
I don't think that Taylor is famous at this level outside of this context, which is not to say that she's not a superstar. It's not to say she's not super famous, but her path through celebrity is not overlapping with most celebrities' path through celebrity. And so she can do this thing where it's evident that she is at the top of the pop pyramid and all these people will come to see her, but you don't see Taylor at like loads of galas, events, premieres, not since, you know, she was younger and still trying to like gain a foothold. her relationship to fame is a little bit cloistered, and you have to go to her to experience Taylor's fame. She's not going to come to you. That's something that I'm consistently struck by, which is that Taylor, during the duration of this Eras Tour summer, is the single most famous person, or one of the two or three most famous people on the planet. And then it'll go away at a certain point, and she'll, like, not that she's not famous or not a superstar, but it's, you're not going to get those consistent reminders. She's not going to show up 100 different places. Like, the thing that is sticking in my mind recently is Questlove did a thing. He was like game night, like Uno night or something. And Taylor showed up. And it's not like Taylor showing up to some super famous person's crazy gala event where there's going to be a zillion paparazzi. She just showed up for this like low key thing. And like, there were a few pictures taken, but like, that's kind of it. Like, she's not doing the things that are guaranteed to get the most notice and attention outside of her own tour. That feels pointed. She's not going to go lend you her celebrity for your cause or your thing. That's at least that's how it scans to me. I wonder what you think of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I remember having the same reaction where when those like the Questlove party photos came out, it felt surprising in that you don't often see her out. I mean, it does feel, even the way like her social media operate, I mean, like the fact that she's not doing press in the same way, the fact that the social media is sort of like, you know, when she has like a release or an announcement, that's what she's using it for. It's not to be like, here's my, every once in a while, I think she did do like 4th of July Instagrams this year, but like, she's not giving you a lot of like the social life, the friends, the birthday parties. She really has drawn all of that in.
No, that feels very like 6 to 8 years ago.
Very 6 to 8 years ago. I think
bacon cookies with Selena Gomez or whenever was.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you don't see any of that. I know that's like that's a general like celebrity trend. I feel like a little bit for like people at her level, but I do feel like it works to her advantage, though, maybe in the way that, because I hadn't thought about this until, it's interesting, because I feel like it makes the Eras Tour feel maybe even then more unmissable for
that's,
a certain
yes,
way.
Yes, that's like, exactly
like,
what I'm saying.
It's like, if you're not, I don't know how much it's like that's going into this, but it's like partly that. It's like, I think you're right. Like, I think when this tour ends, I wouldn't be surprised if like we get very few Taylor sightings for like 6 months or something. Like I think it's going to be like a withdrawing again. And I think she's savvy about this stuff. Like, she knows when she's being seen or not. Like, and I think she'll pull it back maybe to like kind of, I mean, I would imagine that's the case.
I think that's totally, no, that's the vibe I'm feeling. And it's like, you show up for this. This is where you get me, but you don't get me anywhere else.
Yes, yes, I see that.
Josh, a joy and a pleasure to have you.
This is so fun. I love talking with you about all topics, but especially Taylor.
What's a Taylor song that you want to go out on? Whether something you saw live or just something you want to like let heads know like that you're serious about this?
Okay. At the San Francisco show, my surprise songs were Castles Crumbling, sans Haley, and Right Where You Left Me. And I actually feel like Right Where You Left Me really came through for me. Like, I was like feeling Right Where You Left Me, and I kind of forgotten about it. I think it was a bonus track. So I don't know. I think Right Where You Left Me I'm going to go with.
And that is our show. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Every podcast deluxe is on YouTube. That's at tinyurl.com/podcastdeluxe. Get the t-shirts and stickers. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Get in the Discord, get in the Facebook group. Did you see Eras Tour? Do you agree with us? Do you disagree with us? Podcastnytimes.com or tinyurl.com/podcast Facebook or podcast Discord. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Thanks to Josh Dubois. Thanks to Karen Gans. Thanks to Verinda Jagoda. We are finding live footage from San Francisco where Josh was. This is Right Where You Left Me.